Okay, so let's get started. Sorry. Aha. Right. So on the practical, it's finished now. I have one more thing to do because the structure of the practical is the following. You'll be in groups of five. You have basically four. You have to produce a report testing a simple little system. You have four chapters which are done jointly, or four sections that are done jointly. And then the last five sections will be individual one-page reports from each member of the group working on a different topic. The group practical parts, you'll have a tutor that you can act as a consultant, so that there will be four tutors, one for each of the chapters. And I still have to consult with them which ones they would prefer to do. So once I've done that, then I'll release the practical. It'll probably be out either later on this afternoon or tomorrow morning at the latest. And then we can get going on it. And I think that's about all the announcements today. And hopefully I'm beginning to get on top of this now. I started a bit too late and I've been rushing to try and kind of catch up with myself along with all the other things I have to do. So I hope that things are going to settle down from now on. So we're kind of getting into the beginning of really looking at unit testing and about and where we start to do kind of practical things with code. And here we're going to look at specification-based testing. There's a couple of lectures on that. And when we look at specification-based testing, then what we're trying to do is we're thinking about the code as a black box. So what we're doing is we're looking at the specification and we're trying to generate sensible tests from the specification. So it's saying you're presented with a black box, and what you have to do is work out what the best way is to poke it, to try to provoke it to produce some errors, or not to produce some errors. I mean, ideally to behave perfectly. And of course, all of this is it's a very approximate business. It's not really. It certainly isn't foolproof, and it's very much a kind of engineering approach that you do the best you can in the circumstances. And what this lecture will try to do is to just to illustrate some of the issues, and it also will introduce a technique called category partition testing, which is kind of fairly standard technique for taking a particular problem or a particular piece of software and subjecting it to a reasonably systematic and justifiable way to generate tests. Okay, so we'll talk through kind of basic terminology. We'll recap a little bit about this fault, error, failure idea that we discussed in the first lecture, and then we'll talk a little bit about systematic versus randomized testing because they're really about different things. Systematic and randomized testing, they're about finding very different things. And a little bit about the systematic approach to specification-based testing. And I'm not going to do the example. I'm going to do a different example. Yeah, and then you've got the example there because there's one example that appears all the time. There's certainly the one in the book. There's the one that you'll have to do. And then the one in the original Ostrand and Baltzer paper about this is the thing that everybody uses in every single lecture, and it's in these lecture notes as well. So we're going to do a smaller and simpler one that maybe illustrates some of the ideas just as well. Okay, so here's the terminology. And lots of it's subject to choice. It's not the case that for any one particular piece of software, you'll get a unique idea of what, say, an independently testable feature is. So this depends on the control and on the observation that's available in the interface to the system. Yeah, so it's whether you can test something independently depends quite a bit on what interface you get to the software. Yeah, and the idea is that this is something where you can test this feature in relative isolation to the other features round about it. Yeah. So you've got the idea of a test case, and that's the input, the environmental conditions, and the expected results. Now, actually, that's quite important for nearly all programs, so that you talk about what the input looks like. And of course, the inputs, depending on what kind of system you're talking about, can be highly variable. So for example, if you have something that's predominantly graphical user interface, then what the inputs are going to be is gestures. Yeah. So actually, if you look at lots of GUI testing environments, they have the capability of recording gestures. Yeah. Unfortunately, that makes life quite difficult in terms of GUI testing if you take gestures as being really concrete and tied down to where they happen on the screen, because of course the screen placement for Windows and so on varies quite considerably. So really you want to be a little bit abstract when you start talking about gestures and GUIs. The environment is always important. And in the little examples we're looking at, the basic thing that the environment conditions is what files are available. You know, so if you look in pretty much any system that you've ever written, then it's very dependent on what's happening in the file system as to whether it works properly, yeah, and what there is there. Yeah, so there's the issue about, well, what condition is the environment in? So the things you have to fix are what you're going to input to the system, what the environmental conditions are, at least what the file system looks like and various other things, and then what your expected results are. And a test case specification is a property of test cases that identifies a class of test cases. So a test case is, you know, the number 3, yeah? The file X exists in the environment, and the expected result is 10. Yeah? So those are the kind of things that you get with a test case. But a test case specification is something that says, well, if you have something positive and we know that the file X is in the file system and it's non-empty, yeah, then we'd expect the output to be something which bears the following relation to the input. Let's say, 2X plus 4. Yeah. So that's the kind of thing where you get with a test case specification. A test suite is a collection of test cases. Why do we introduce the idea of test case specification? That's the other thing. The idea of, we're always dealing with categories of things when we're talking about testing. And the idea of a test case specification is it kind of specifies something where you don't really expect the behavior of the program to be very different from any of the test cases. So if you like, the idea of test case specification is it's intended to capture the idea that inside of that, all possible values are equivalent in terms of what the exercise in the system. So ideally what we want to do is to come up with a collection of test case specifications that kind of exhausts all the possibility of the behavior of the system. So that's what we're looking at. Test suite's a collection of test cases, and a test suite for a system may comprise several test suites for each independently testable function. And test is the activity of executing the system for a particular test case. Yeah, so that's it. So generally, the way that we work is we look at the code, we try and come up with a set of test case specifications, and then from the test case specifications, we choose a set of tests, and then we run the code against the test. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you look at it in the context of something like JUnit, then what that does is the setup part sets up the environment to be what we'd expect it to be in terms of the particular test case. Then the tests subject the input, and the asserts in the tests give us what the expected results are. Yeah? Okay. So, well, that's interesting. Yeah, okay. this is a slightly different model from the one that I mentioned last time. There's two different models, but this is false errors and failures. So an error is a mistake made by a programmer. A fault is a collection of program source code statements that causes a failure. And a failure is an external incorrect behavior of the program. So we're interested in looking at failures.
and we're looking at we're interested in looking at how faults cause failures. Yeah. So, and ideally, when we're trying to fix something, if we're interested in bug fixing, then we're interested in looking at the failure, trying to find the fault, and then fixing the fault. Today, we're mostly going to focus on on unit testing. And usually, what that involves is constructing quite a lot of scaffolding code around the classes that you're interested in looking at. So here, these lights aren't right. Let me see if I can. Yeah. Error and fault, yeah, hang on, I will. Yeah. Okay, so we'll go back. So here, I'll show you, actually, I should explain, because there are two very different models of this. Yeah, and it's confusing, because this is one here. So. This is this model, and I'll explain it. Yeah, so you've got the developer, yeah, thinking about the code, and they have some kind of misconception. So I don't know. They think that gravity should be represented as a negative number rather than a positive number. Yeah, okay. So this is something like, so they have some kind of misconception. That's an error in this model. Yeah, because it's some kind of erroneous belief about the world. Yeah. And then what they do is they write some code. And this misconception causes them to produce something which is faulty. Because they use this negative number to calculate the thrust that some lander should have, yeah? And it's going in the wrong direction, so it actually accelerates the lander towards the thing. Then what happens is this thing gets executed in an environment, yeah? Okay. And that leads to a failure. If I was a better graphic artist, I'd write my spacecraft, yeah, with a large crater round about it sitting on the surface of the planet it's trying to land on, yeah? So the idea here is the error is something that somebody does, yeah? This produces faulty stuff, yeah? And eventually this produces a failure. And of course, if what you're going to do is to not encounter the failure, then ultimately what you need to do is to fix the error in the developer's head so that they don't do it again. Yeah? But a more modest gate goal is that somebody else comes along, looks at the failure, finds the fault, yeah, which is a bug, and then fixes the bug. Yeah? Okay? Now, the model I talked about in the first lecture is a slightly different one where the idea of error, and this has to do with the idea of latent failures. So the one that I had was you have a fault, it causes an error in the internal state of the system, and then that results in a failure. So this is a more kind of cognitively based one where you're thinking about somebody's state of mind. Yeah? And this state of mind causes, the error in the state of mind causes the fault, and that eventually leads to failure. Okay? Good. Okay, so when we're doing unit testing, we might very well end up having to write quite a lot of scaffolding code, because if you're trying to do class A under test, and that links to class B and class C, I mean, here you could imagine that you've got some big class diagram with a set of dependencies on it. Then probably what you'll have to do is you probably have to end up producing some code which will respond in some way or another when A makes a demand on it. Because what you don't want is, because these two things here are untested, yeah, you don't want to just give control over to that. Yeah, because it may well be that you see errors in class A, but they're actually coming from faults in, you may well see failures in the performance of Class A, but those are actually coming from faults or failures of Class B or Class C. Yeah? And that would be the case over here, where this is the real code. So ideally what you have to do is you have to write a mock Class B and a mock Class C in order to support your testing. And then you know what you're getting back. Yeah? And that does it. And sometimes, you know, you can work in environments where you can see what the demand is being made on Class B, and you can actually say, well, okay, make it this response this time, or you can see what's happening when you get a demand on Class C and you say make another response to it. Yeah. But in general, you might have to construct quite a lot of stuff in order to do that. And then later on, when you start looking at integration, you start thinking about how to put things together. So here you might test Class D in a test framework, and that's got no dependencies. So if you like, that doesn't depend on anything. Of course, it'll depend on the libraries and various other things that are in the world. And similarly, Class C under test. So you test 1 and 3 and do the unit test work on that. And then you'd look at doing this integration test where you take Class B and you look at how it integrates with Class D, and then you might add Class B here and look and see how the whole thing integrates, yeah, in terms of Class B, Class C, and Class D here. And then what you're looking at is you're interested in this interface here. Here you're interested in this interface here. Yeah. So for this structure that we had on the previous page, then you test Class D, and then you test Class B integrated with Class D, then you test Class C, and then you bring them together, make the integration, and the whole thing, you'd look at Class A's performance relative to that. So it would. So for this, when you're looking at integration, you'd have a four-step process. Yeah, let's integrate, let's test D, integrate with Class B, test C, and then integrate Class B and D with Class C in Class A. Of course, there isn't a unique kind of tree decomposition, certainly not in any object-oriented programming that you're ever likely to encounter. So these things are going to be used in lots of other places. So as you test classes, then what you do is you build up your unit testing and you slowly integrate. And of course, if you do it this way, then you might have to write, I mean, if you really trust the outcomes of this test, you might have to write less scaffolding code, because you'd really use Class D here when you were testing Class B. But you shouldn't really do it except when you're doing the integration test. So for the unit test, you should really have a scaffold there rather than the real thing. The next couple of bits are, how many of you have ever seen or competed in the International Collegiate Programming Competition? Have you all heard of it? Yeah, it's a big competition that the ACM, the Association for Computing Machinery Works, runs. We actually entered a team this year. Yeah, we came 12th out of 70 in the Northwest Europe finals, which is actually, given that we only had a couple of weeks practice before we did it, it was quite good. But hopefully we'll do better next time. But they've got this fantastic resource where they have loads and loads and loads and loads of problems that you can submit to an online judge. So basically what you do is you write your solution and then you punt the solution off to the online judge. It used to be in Spain, they had the online judging site. And what that actually does is it stores all the correct and incorrect solutions to the thing, to the problems. And this is some work that a friend of mine did, yeah? And what he did was he looked at, this is a bit of work. This is just looking at, I can't remember the exact problem here, but this is looking at something which it took two integer parameters, yeah? And they were in the range, you know, you could expect the range 0 to 150, and here 0 to 200 was the range of inputs, yeah? And he ran them through the judge, doing parameter scans on them and seeing when the things passed the judge or failed the judge. Yeah? And each black spot on here is a failure of a program, of a particular solution given the specification. So, and if you look, even for something simple with two integer parameters in that range, things start to get quite complicated. So here, you've got something which just every so often fails on the zero input value. Mm-hmm. Okay. Here is something where you've got a hard failure, where basically the magnitude of this thing is greater than the magnitude of the x parameter, so that's this one. This one, virtually everything is clear, there's hardly any errors at all, except for here, at the extreme value, where somebody's clearly got, there's something wrong at the end of a loop, or there's something goes wrong at some kind of boundary condition in the parameter values. Here, then, I mean, this is probably a fairly hacky solution. It kind of works reasonably well, but except for certain things which are just completely wrong. These are probably at boundaries in the input values where the behavior has to behave differently. And then you get these pretty ones, where you have lots of errors, But if you look at it, I mean, even if you look at this one, really most of the parameter space, so this is what? It's roughly, it's 200 by 200, So we're talking about, 40,000 values, roughly, And actually, almost all of them are correct, except for a few in the edge. Here, well, actually, there's an awful lot of white, And if you got it wrong, it's be quite easy if you'd be fairly easy in this case, There are hundreds of errors there, maybe even thousands. But if you selected tests, then you might very well just always hit white space here. Yeah? So it's not an easy situation. I mean, here the errors look like they've got some kind of systematic relationship to one another. So you might have a hope of finding them. But I think this one, I mean, in terms of testing advice, you'd be advised, to look at the boundaries, to look close to the boundary values. But if you didn't do that, then you wouldn't find anything at all, in there. One of the things he was doing for this is the last little bit of anecdote. He compared the solutions between the guys who submitted C and the guys who submitted Java, And he found that. And he actually looked at the comparison between the likelihood of co-occurrence of errors, Java to Java, C to C, and Java to C. And he found that the errors that occurred in Java programs were almost completely independent from the errors that occurred in C programs. So actually, if what you did was you forced two teams to produce two different systems, one in Java and one in C, the likelihood that the errors co-occurred is extremely small. So if you ran your testing, you just did lots and lots of random testing, compared the output from one to the output of the other, then you'd be highly likely to find nearly all the errors in the system. So in other words, from two things that had, say, one error in 1,000 attempts, you could quite easily build a system with a lot of testing where you'd end up with something that was one failure in 10 to the 6 inputs. So it was quite a nice piece of work, actually. So, and then, I mean, just going on, he also found that some systems have got, I mean, some failed examples. Of course, there wasn't really any quality control over these because they were just coming in from universities all over the world and people were testing them. And some things got simple shapes, but as you saw in the previous things, it's by no means a dead cert that you're actually going to find that you're going to have a nice, tidy set of errors to look at. So small faults are hard to find using random tests. Yeah, so those graphs, very simple programs. Some cases, there's a clear connection between the faults in the code and the patterns. But lots of faults, they're just scattered about, and you can't really see any good pattern. And they're very hard to find if you use a random testing approach. And a random testing approach is really what you want to do if you're interested in something like determining the reliability of the bit of code. Because what you say is, I have some distribution of the inputs. Now, that might be that all inputs are equally likely. Yeah. Actually, for most programs, that's extremely unlikely. Yeah. All inputs being equiprobable is extremely unlikely. Yeah. If you look at the program we're going to look at later is CAT in Unix. Mm-hmm. How many times do you use CAT with more than three files? Yeah. Do you know that? You know the program? It's where you say CAT F1, F2, F3, and then what happens is you get file 1 followed by file 2 followed by file 3 just copied to the output. Mm-hmm. How many times do you think it gets used with more than three files? Yeah, probably almost never, except if it's in a script. Yeah, when it might be used for the massive number of files all of a sudden. But actually, if you look at it in terms of day-to-day use in terms of Unix users, then it almost never occurs with three or more files. And certainly, one or two is by far the more common thing to do. So it's the case that if you look at random testing and you look at the distribution derived from the use of the software, then what you find is that actually if you just start random testing, then it's quite unlikely that you're going to find bugs. And you have to try a very, very large numbers of inputs to get anything that's at all statistically reliable. But that's the kind of testing you have to do if you want to make a prediction about the reliability of the program. Yeah. And most predictions about reliability of programs are actually made from real running data. You know, once the program's out there in the world, post hoc people say, okay, well, what performance, what reliability have I got? So how likely is it to fail in so many hours of operation? Or how likely is it to fail on a demand to see that it'll perform the way it performs? I mean, again, I'll just break off for a moment there. If you look at the most demanding software requirement in the UK that isn't to do with avionics, yeah, is actually in nuclear protection systems. Yeah? So if you look at a nuclear protection system in the UK, a software primary protection system, that's something that shuts down the reactor if something goes wrong, is expected to be at least as good as one failure in 10 to the 4 demands. Yeah, so it'll only fail 1 in 10,000 times that you ask it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, the fact of the matter is it'll probably only ever get asked 3 or 4 times in the entire lifetime of the reactor. Yeah, so that might give you some comfort. But the other thing is that in general, there are actually layers of defense. So the stuff that goes around it, you know, the enclosure, the containment that goes around the reactor will contain most things that happen inside it, whether or not the primary protection fails or not. So actually, but it's surprisingly modest, yeah? And it's much more modest than anything that you'd expect to see in the avionics industry, because there you've got loads of stuff where they're saying this stuff is better than one failure in a million flying hours, yeah? Which is actually a much more demanding thing than one failure in 10,000 demands, which is what the nuclear industry demand. But they demand very, very solid evidence for that. And actually what they require is that the system is demonstrated to have that level of reliability in it. And I think the last nuclear power station that was built in the UK, which was Sizewell B, which is down on the Essex coast, after a couple of years, the regulator said, well, the software isn't good enough. So you actually have to, we're not going to use that as a primary protection. You're going to have to install a mechanical, an electromechanical primary protection system. And you use that as the second line of defense after the after the software system has failed. Yeah, so, and that was just because they didn't feel like they had enough evidence to say it was good enough. It did have some pretty tricky stuff in there, actually. This is about kind of looking at reliability testing and looking at using random testing. I mean, a good example of somewhere where people did eventually find something is that, you know, that Intel had with their Pentium processor a few years back, it cost them 6 months turnover or something like that. It was a massive amount of money because they eventually had to recall. They tried to manage it, yeah. They said, hardly ever anybody will ever see this, yeah. So it had a 10 to the minus 9 probability of occurring across the whole space of possible floating point values. And the maximum error was less than 10 to the minus 5, yeah. But the probability, yeah, of that occurring was actually 10 to the minus 11. Yeah, so you would only get the maximum error, yeah, 1 in 10 to the 11 times that you tried to put in random arguments into the Pentium floating point unit. This was caused, by the way, because they changed to a new, different kind of floating point division algorithm, and the person who was implementing it didn't understand it properly. Yeah, and there actually was a systematic bug in the code, well, you know, in the silicon, yeah, for the floating point division. So, and he tried to say, well, you know, really, mostly nobody will ever come across that. Yeah, but then there was a howl of derision on the internet, and then they basically had to recall every single Pentium processor and replace it for anybody who wanted it. Yeah, it cost them a vast amount of money to do that. It was discovered by some guy who was looking for twin primes. Yeah, so he did lots and lots and lots and lots of divisions. Yeah, so he was doing some kind of big search. Look, you know, these twin primes that are odd numbers, which are the successive odd numbers. Yeah, where you have something where basically 2n+1 and 2n+3 is prime. So he was. And he discovered that actually this bug caused him all kinds of problems in his program. And then they eventually came up with this picture, but it didn't convince people that it was a negligible problem. Okay. So again, that's something that didn't come up in their testing. So here's the issue that we've got: systematic versus random testing. The spaces are really large, you know, so we've got a system with 232-bit integers input has 264 possible test cases. No, it hasn't. It's a lot more than that. but relative to this number of potential tests, the number of tests that we can apply is always tiny. Random sampling means that we can automate and apply a very large number of tests. Even then, the coverage remains small, particularly for complex problems. And so, for example, in the case of buffer overrun or something like that, the likelihood of adding a very, very long sequence of elements is very small, just because it takes you a very long time to get there. So faults with small profiles, size of input spaces, force a hybrid, yeah, where we consider some systematic testing, possibly reinforced with randomized testing. And systematic testing means looking at the code's specification and trying to work from that. Okay. So in here, this is from Young and Petsy. It's not readable though. Okay, so I thought it was, but it isn't. So here, this is really the route that you're talking. So here we analyze the specification and we identify our independently testable features. We partition into categories, yeah, the significant cases for each parameter. We determine some constraints to reduce the size of the test space, and then we write and process a test specification, produce some test cases, and then we may need to return to the categories and constraints. We create test cases and then execute the test cases and then evaluate the results. So this is the process for a systematic approach to it, and you'll see in a minute what that means. Yeah. So we work from a functional specification, and it could be a completely formal specification, but often what we end up with is just something that says, well, it's supposed to do this. And you'll see in the practical, the thing you're going to be asked to test, it doesn't actually have a formal specification, but intuitively you kind of know what it should mean. Yeah. And often we can produce these functional specifications fairly easily, but for some things it's much, much harder. And I think GUIs is the really difficult one. Because it's really hard to say exactly what it is that a GUI is supposed to be doing. So independently testable features. Here we slice the specification into features, and that might spread across many, many code modules. And each feature should be independent of the other, so we can concentrate on one at a time. And the design of the code has a big influence on this, because it might make it easier or more difficult, depending on how much attention has been given to testability. So the whole area of how do you do design for test, how do you encourage design for test, is something that I think is really quite undeveloped in in software. It's quite well developed because it needs to be in hardware. Yeah? If you look at testing, if you look at big chips that get produced, then quite often there'll be a certain proportion of the silicon will be devoted just being able to access places in the chip that you can't normally get access to, because you're worried about some bits being stuck at particular values, or you're worried about internal data transfers. And so there's a whole bunch of testing logic actually on the chips, which allows you to automate the testing of the chips, and actually means that what they can do is, when they manufacture things, they have reasonably high reliability that anything that they actually put into a package will work. Because actually the yields on these things aren't fantastic. I mean, you do lose stuff. And the yields that will go faster, that will go at the maximum clock speeds, are lower than the ones that will go at lower clock speeds. So typically what they do at the end of a chip line is they have all kinds of ways of checking, see whether it's a good one or a bad one, see if it's a very good one, see if it's an excellent one, and then sell them at different prices, actually. Yeah, so that's the kind of idea that goes on. So we'll look at model-based testing in a later lecture, but here we're just considering classes of values that all generate similar behavior, yeah? And that will result in a very large number of potential classes of input for non-trivial programs. But we identify constraints that disallow certain combinations of classes. Yeah? And the goal is to reduce the number of potential test cases by eliminating combinations that don't make sense. So test case specification and test cases. From the partitions that we generate, we can generate test case specifications. And then what we have to do is we have to decide what values we choose there. And it may be that there are very many test case specifications. We need to manage them, and it isn't probably possible to fully automate the process of checking that test case matches a specification. So the thing is that, and even in the running of things, yeah, is the answer correct? Is the environment set up properly? Can be quite difficult questions to answer. Right, This is going to go into an example now, and I'm going to do a simpler one, and hopefully it will go quicker. And actually, we can do it in parallel with this. So this is they're both Unix command line things, because it's an easy thing. Should be an easy thing to understand. Yeah. So we have something like cat, and then we have F1 up to Fn, and then optionally we have that we can redirect. I'm just considering this this setup. And what we do is, when we look at this, we think about what are the independently testable functions of this. And here, I'm only going to consider one. I mean, there are other things that you can use cat for than this, because it's got various kinds of overloaded things to do with where it takes its inputs from and so on. But here, the independently testable function is that it concatenates F1 through to Fn, and optionally stores in file. Yeah, so here, this is our independently testable function in this particular case. We've got two parameters here. This is our inputs, the input list, and this is our output file. Okay, so there we are. And okay, so I'll just flip through this. Yeah, this has got some stuff. So here, yeah. So in the find example that we've just got, then what you do is it identifies a number of different independently testable functions, because the code will actually check to see whether the inputs are malformed. I mean, this would also happen in cat. Yeah. And then what we do is we identify the parameters, and then we identify what needs to be the case in the environment. Mm-hmm. Okay. So here we have a parameter and it's our input list, yeah, so that's the parameter, and then we identify the categories of things that we're interested here. Now I'm just going to take one thing I'm interested in, yeah, and that's going to be the length of the list. And then I've got parameter, and it's the output file, okay, and that's, I'm not going to take any, I'm just going to say, well, the only thing we're interested here is whether it's present or not. And that's my category for this one. Okay. And then finally, I worry about the environment. And here, I'm just going to look here and say, well, what are my interesting things? What are my situations in the environment that I'm interested in? Yeah. So, and that might be on the input files. And that's going to be present, not present. And then on the output, it's going to be whether it's present or not. Those are the features that I'm interested in, the categories I'm interested in. Yeah. So here I've got my parameters. So I've got input list, output list, and my environment. And here these are the features in the environment I'm interested in. And then I'm interested in a category that I'm interested in about the input list. So here it's length of list, and here it's whether the output file is present or not. Yeah. Okay. And then what I do is I look at categories, so I look at partitions for each of these categories. So the length of list here, I say, well, I want to partition it into that the list might be empty, the list might be single, the list might be multiple. Yeah. So those are three different partitions for this category on the input. And then on the output file, present or not, then I might want to have, I'll have two different categories, which is that it's present or it's absent. Okay. And then present or not present for the input files, this is all present or all or some absent. Yeah? So it's, I might say all present, that's one category, and some absent. Yeah, so in other words, there are some of the input files that aren't there. And then here on the output file, I'll say I want it to be present in the environment or not present in the environment. Okay? Yeah? Is that okay? So what I've done is I say, let's look at my parameters. Let's identify categories of feature about the parameter, and then let's partition the categories. So here I can have more than one category about my input list, but I've only taken one here. So here there are many more. Yeah, it's pattern size, quoting, embedded blanks, embedded quotes. So it's a more detailed thing. And then what I do is I identify here the partitions that I'm interested in. Yeah? So it's empty, single, multiple. And what that does is it splits that list, the big domain of all possible lists of files, into three different categories. Okay? Now, what this does is it basically sets up my potential testing space. Mm-hmm. Because here, I've got three possibilities in terms of categories. Here, I've got two possibilities. Here, in terms of the environment, I have two possibilities. And here, I have two possibilities. Okay? And so what I have is I have 6 times 4, yeah? So I have 24 different combinations of environmental constraints and inputs variability, yeah? And so what I do, well, what would I do? I'd probably build 4 test suites, mm-hmm, for this. And my 4 test suites would be the 4 possibilities here in terms of whether the files are some present, all present, or some absent, yeah, okay, and whether the output file is present or not. So I build those 4 different in my setup part in the test suite for JUnit, yeah. Then what I'd do is I'd build 4 different ones that had those different environmental setups. Mm-hmm. If I was doing this, if I had a cat function in JUnit that took a list and the output file. And then I'd look at these 6 possibilities here, and I'd have six tests, yeah, test cases that corresponded to each of the test specifications. Because each of these 6 possibilities, in other words, you know, empty present, empty absent, single present, single absent, multiple absent, yeah, gives me a class of potential input values I could use for my test. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so then what I do is I'd have 4 suites 6 tests each tweet, and I'd construct my test set, and I'd go ahead and do it. Yeah? Okay. But 24 tests is nothing, as you know, yeah, because when you were testing scalene, yeah, the scalene triangle thing, we came up with 13 or 14 tests just off the top of our heads in this room, didn't we? Yeah? Mm-hmm. Okay. So, so there's a problem, and the problem is you get a massive number of possible of possible combinations of these things. And so what's the way around this? Well, I'll show you on the how do we cut down? Yeah? So for the find example here, that's in the slides, you end up with 432 different test frames. Yeah? So you end up with 432 different possibilities for test cases. And if you look at that, there are six possible environmental setups. Yeah, and then 48 different tests for each of the environment setups. However, there is at least one way of getting out of this, and it's this idea, and I'll come back and look at it here. So it's this idea of saying that there are constraints in the situation, and what you do is you say you only include certain things if a particular constraint is true. So, for example, in terms of pattern size, you say, well, if the pattern is empty, then we say that the test case has property empty. The test case specification has property empty. If it's single, then it has a property non-empty, multiple property non-empty, too long property non-empty. So this is just like saying, if the pattern size has one of these ones, then the overall test case has non-empty as its property. And if it has this one, then it has empty as its property. If the pattern is quoted, then it has a property quoted. And pattern not quoted only makes sense if the pattern size is non-empty. Yeah? And then whether the pattern has embedded blanks, yeah? You only want to consider none if it's non-empty.